Hey, Mike, do you remember that vet student we had on last year that got into vet school with no GCSEs?
Jamil Dowling.
That's right, yeah.
He ran away to Bolivia or something.
Ah, he did, but he's back now. Should we get him on?
Fantastic.
Great.
Hi, I'm Mike Brampton.
And my name is Julian Ho.
Welcome to Veterinary Ramblings.
So, Jamil, last time we spoke, you were in Armenia. You were still a student. You'd not got any GCSEs or A-levels. And you blagged and bluffed your way into vet school. And now you appear to be out the other end and you're a vet.
Yeah. I did get my A-levels and GCSEs. I don't think I blagged that bit. But I think it'd be pretty hard.
Although I was embroidering this a little bit.
With the number of vet schools popping up, I do think venture requirements are dropping by the looks of it, from what I've heard.
No.
What you're saying, they don't make vet students like they used to.
They look so young, don't they?
Yeah. I think there's a lot going on with the vet industry in regards to students right now. And I think a lot of the issues are more of an indicator of more of a systemic issue that's going on, at least with the profession in the UK.
Mm-hmm.
I'm saying that without having practiced in the UK, and I've only been registered as practicing outside. But just seeing it from outside and the kind of job offers and stuff I've got from other countries and other companies, there is a drastic difference.
Tell us about it.
Yeah.
Obviously, I haven't done it here, so I might be completely wrong.
Okay. You've obviously got an impression of the career progression through from uni, finals, qualification, graduation, and then fire away from where? And
yes,
in contrast,
in the UK, I feel like to gain the sort of skills and stuff that I'd like to gain in the sort of period I want to do it in, I think it would take me a lot longer in the UK. Whereas by going to other countries, not only are you rewarded both financially and with benefits to the job at a higher level than they're currently offering in the UK, but to me it seems like there's opportunities that are easier to access as a new grad. So like a lot of the surgical training and stuff here, all I've heard from my peers is that they only get one surgery day a week, which to me is a very small amount, especially after coming like off the back of Mexico, where we're just doing like spay and neuters and we're doing it on basketball courts on the roadside. Obviously maintaining the highest standard we could for these animals, but it means you do get that volume of experience in. And by going to Bolivia, I got a lot of experience with wildlife that I'm guessing if you did the traditional route within England, you'd probably have to do two rotating internships, get a residency in zoological medicine. I'm guessing for the things I've been able to do recently, I've maybe cut out 2 to 3 years of time. Not that I have the knowledge or the experience that would come with that time, but I have been allowed to access those opportunities and put the knowledge into practice sooner. I've got a job offer in the US, but I didn't get the visa, which is with one of the emergency companies out there. The amount of training you get with them in those first 6 months, to me, seems like the sort of training you might spread across 2 years in the UK. Mm-hmm. So they focus on bringing you up to a level so that then you can go and be an emergency doctor. Whereas here, I feel like because you don't get the volume and the repetitions in early on, because you're so low down in the ladder, because obviously there's people who've graduated 2 years ago who still want to gain confidence in bitch space or surgeries. You know, you're right at the bottom. And as a student, you're right at the bottom as well. Out there, it seems like there's opportunities. They also pay a lot better, which means you have budget to then decide, I want to train myself. I'm going to pay £3,000 to go and do this surgical course somewhere. This particular job, they had actually unlimited CPD budget.
You mentioned their skills, and you said that potentially, that I'm going to call it the traditional UK system.
Yeah.
And I know it's changing, it's evolving, and we're investing a lot of time, effort, and energy in students and onward mentoring post-graduation, which is all good stuff. So what specific skills would you like to develop, or have you gone after yourself? because that equally is not necessarily everybody's cup of tea, is it?
No. The key skills for me coming out of university were to gain experience in wildlife and rehabilitation centres, and the more low resource, you know, you've got to work with what you have. But so to get experience that would allow me to then, it doesn't really matter where I go in the world, that I'll be able to adapt to their system. And I feel like here, because we always aim for gold standard, at least through our academic training, which I completely understand why, you lose those core principles that allow you to think on your feet. Since I graduated, I haven't touched an anesthetic machine, to be honest. That might make Mike angry.
Each to their own. Just because I love anesthesia, I'd probably make a lousy orthopedic surgeon.
No, I'd love to have those sort of things there to be able to work with animals under a more stable sedation. But by virtue of not having them there, it forces you to learn how to use the bare minimum. At the center I was in Bolivia, we were lucky in the sense that we had medetomidine. When I went into the local towns to help the local vets, it's going to sound horrendous, but I saw people using xylazine, ketamine, and ACP for a bitch spay. And obviously, there's not much analgesia there.
And well, the xylazine has a reasonable amount. Ketamine has actually quite adequate
analgesia. I saw the animals wake up a couple of times, like from the pain when they were tugging at the ligament to break it. I ended up finding midazolam and ketamine and then doing it with that and topping them up with tramadol. We couldn't get hold of morphine or any other opioid. Mm. That worked a lot better. Dogs didn't wake up. Obviously, they were working with what they had. And I learned loads. Like, I'd never really combined xylazine and ACP at university. I'd never used xylazine in a small animal at university.
And no, I haven't used xylazine for 15, 16 years. From memory, the sedation was a little bit variable and it made them really quite slobbery.
And obviously xylazine can induce emesis as well, which is the other problem out there, because a lot of people would bring the animals without having fasted them overnight, or they gave them breakfast and brought them to the vet. That risk for aspiration pneumonia was a lot higher. But we worked with it. It worked well. Some of them vomited. You just had to be very on it the minute they did vomit. Make sure there was nothing there, clear it out, and then crack on with whatever you had to do. But the other problem was the duration of action was a lot shorter. So then you had to get used to working faster, because otherwise you're going to end up doing a lot of top-ups with a drug that hasn't got as wide a safety margins as medetomidine, that gives you like a nice 45 minutes, usually. Okay. Maybe 30, depends. But
okay, so that's super stuff and quite detailed. What general skills were you looking for?
My general thing was to gain experience with surgery and kind of more, a patient comes in, you're not sure what's going on with them, how to stabilize them to the point where you then can figure things out.
Okay.
And a lot of wildlife stuff was that, because we had no history from the patient, or if we did, it was records of every 3 months they've been seen doing this, or it's very difficult to get a weight off a wild animal once they've been released. Even if you had to dart an animal, you had to get very good at estimating animals' weights across a wide range of species. Like, it's easy once you get used to that species. Like for horses, I'm pretty sure equine vets are probably going to get it almost very accurate, like 90 to 100% of the time. But then maybe swap them to try and estimate the weight of a capuchin and all their fluff. And that's something I realized at the beginning. I was like, I'm not that great at estimating weights. Like, we didn't kill anything. And I think, but I struggled more than just looking at a dog and being like, oh yeah, he's 7-ish kilos, like max 10.
Yeah.
A monkey, sometimes I was like, oh, he's high up in the ranking. He looks strong and stuff. And then I'd weigh him and he'd weigh like 2.7 or 3.
I was going to say, he looks like 20 kilos at least. Oh, why can I pick him up with my fingertips?
Exactly.
Yeah.
But the main skill I really wanted, to be honest, was more surgical experience.
Okay.
And from everything I'd heard and seen from people in England, I wasn't going to find the volume I was looking for. Okay. My pre-graduation, my goal was to get 100 bitch spays under my belt, which I didn't achieve. I guess it's good to have a very ambitious goal, but
yeah.
The Mexico trip in particular, we did a lot of surgeries, and that was like Figs, which is a scrubs brand. They took a load of ambassadors out. We just went and did all the surgeries for free with Baja, Spey, and Nusa. And those sort of opportunities, when I was looking at the university, cost a fortune to do. So just to have that amount of talent brought to one place, even though it was only a week long, is incredible because you get to pick everyone's brains.
I wanted to add a couple of points because I'm listening to all this,
yeah,
bursting with excitement to try and get in and ask some questions. But I'm well aware that Mike and I have so many questions we want to ask you, so many ways we want to tug this. You mentioned you have unlimited CPD.
Yeah.
And I was going to get back to that and say that what we have in this country, I think, is an increasingly good mentor system for new grads.
Yep.
That teaches them to work as best they can in an increasingly corporate environment and an increasingly litigious environment. And so do you feel the experience you've got has enabled you to cope in a litigious environment and in a corporate environment?
The job offer I had for the US was corporate. The one I'm going to now in Australia is an independent practice.
Mm-hmm.
I try not to look at it on the basis of corporate versus independent, which I feel like there's a lot of bias there.
I wasn't talking about the multi-corporate. I was talking more of a business environment.
Okay.
Doing wildlife work, doing rehabilitation and things like that with wild animals is very different from treating Mrs. Miggins' dog that needs a dental and you need to get the best equipment in your practice to deal with that.
So in more developed countries of more developed medical equipment, I think you can present the client with three options, right? And then they get to pick what option suits them best. So you can go for, look, this is the bare minimum, or maybe even four options, right? Euthanasia, worst case scenario, it's not easy for anyone. They probably don't want to do it, but because of life circumstances, it's got to that point, or adoption, or into a rescue. Then you've got the lowest level of care that you can provide to the best of your capacity with those resources. The middle ground, which isn't gold standard, but it's not bad. It'll get the job done, but there can be maybe more complications, or it's not as fast, or it's not as good on anesthetic because you don't have as fancy tools to speed things up. And then you can have the gold standard, which is the best and I guess makes you the most immune to getting sued, which is that question. But by offering them,
never say that. Never
say that. I guess it doesn't make you immune, but it does give you a solid defense, right? Ish. Unless you've made a mistake and you've covered it up or something like that.
That's the thing. We can all make mistakes.
Yeah.
We all make mistakes. We're human. We can all make mistakes. And I'm going to interrupt you, Flo, just for a moment, because I think this is important for you and for anyone listening in. We do make mistakes. I make mistakes, hopefully fewer, more rarely than when I did when I first qualified, but I still make mistakes. What will help you to reduce the number of times clients complain, and what will help you to reduce those complaints to fewer litigious events, are three things. The first is honesty. The second thing is communication. And the third thing is honesty and communication. And it really is as simple as that, isn't it, Mike?
I don't know. I've heard this secondhand, but I don't know how much data there is behind it. But a lot of people are scared of saying sorry. I've heard in the past, I don't know if this is a US thing, just because of that sensation of guilt. But actually, it might seem like when you're that honest and you apologize and you're up front, I don't know if this is true, so I'd have to look this up, but there might be a lower chance.
There are ways of apologizing without saying, I'm sorry I did this. I'm sorry I did this. Is an
admission. I think it's the admission of liability.
Yes.
Has the lawyers a bit twitchy and that the people are listening for. And as Julian says, there are ways of empathizing with the situation and apologizing without admitting the liability aspect of it. Is that where you were going with that, Julian?
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely that. I'm very sorry for you that this has happened is a fine thing to say. You're empathizing, you're being compassionate. I'm very sorry this has happened for you. Not, I'm very sorry I did this. That would be a no. And your legal advisors will say, no, don't say that. But you can say to someone, look, gosh, I'm sorry for you. I understand how you're feeling. I understand that this has happened. And it's very regrettable that this happened. Let's try and understand why it's happened. And hopefully, if you've done your job well, you'll have explained to them before the procedure that there is a chance this might happen.
Mm. Yeah.
And that's where the communication comes in.
Yeah.
Look, I'm very, very sorry for you that this has happened. If you remember, this was one of the things that I cautioned you about. We spoke about it at some length, and we agreed that there was a risk of this happening, but that we would try everything we could to avoid that actually happening. But we can't stop it from happening all the time. It happens, you know, that sort of thing. Yeah.
I think, end of the day, everyone just needs to remember that doctors are humans too. We all make mistakes. Mistakes do happen. Not that I'm allowed to make mistakes, but if you went into an op and every time it was like, if you make a single mistake, you will lose your life. With that mentality, I think you'd go in more stressed. And I think it's what you have mentioned. The key is, if you explain things well to the client, if you make it very clear what the risks are, even if they are minimal and they have that informed consent, then you've got a very good point to start from with them. And I guess if they feel excluded from the beginning, again, talking of a limited amount of experience, but if they feel more excluded or feel like you've talked down to them or you're in a rush, it's very hard to balance volume of patients coming in, you staying on top of the number of cases you need to keep up with, and also give people the time they think they deserve and probably do.
You raise a lot of good points there, a lot of good points. I think it's very appropriate. And as Julian says, communication is one of the keys there. One of the other things that you could add into that would be setting a level of expectation. And one of the dangers when you say you're going to throw the MRI and this, that, and the other at it is that there is a level of expectation because you've gone to that level that everything will work out. And there's also the aspect of introducing that level into the conversation and potentially handing over that case when maybe with some straightforward talking, a straight understanding, that is a case that you can take on to the level of the equipment and your skills and your surroundings that will do the best for them as well as the patient and yourself. Because equally, you set the expectation high, you're also increasing your own expectation levels and the pressure associated with that. Yes. But that's another thing. I think that's important stuff. So the surgical skill thing, that was your thing, wasn't it? That's what you wanted to, base surgical skills.
I enjoy surgery, yeah.
A lot of vets are problem solvers. And so I can really relate. I remember many years ago getting involved heavily in pre-hospital medicine and human side. And that really used to excite me. That was a visceral thing because with cold surgery, routine surgery, you pretty much knew what you were going to face.
Yeah.
But with the emergency side, and you're a bit of a risk taker, aren't you? You do this climbing thing and stuff like that, like Julian does.
I wouldn't say take unnecessary risks in surgeries. I don't
I'm suggesting that as a personality type, you're quite prepared to put yourself out there. And so the idea of taking on emergency care where you've got no real backup, you've got no real history, you've got to find out what has precipitated the events that are in front of you and deal with them.
But so from what I've experienced just in the last 7-8 months, sometimes you won't find out what precipitated it. And you need to make clinical decisions and stuff that are going to save the animal in that moment. Yep. An example that I'm happy to go into details. When I got to Bolivia, one of the first cases we had, the name of this monkey was Celia. She had always been a bit more of an outlier from the bigger group. She had been released completely. So she was wild. She was still semi-friendly with certain people or the director who's been there for 20 odd years and recognizes faces. But she initially came to the clinic and people saw her as a bit weak and stuff. And she ended up having a rectal prolapse. Mm-hmm. And it was like, okay, cool. Pop it back in per string, mm-hmm. give her some pain relief, monitor for a day. She seemed to get better. We removed the purse string, didn't pop back out, but we had no bloods. We had none of the sort of testing that you would usually do before a surgery. And she had perked up. She was eating a lot better and stuff. So we tried a soft release, but only a few days later, she was right by the clinic door. And in a weird way, it felt like she was asking for help because mm-hmm. they don't always, I don't know if they know that. I don't know why I'm imagining that, but she showed up at the clinic twice when she was sick, at the clinic, not at the kitchen, anywhere else. She came in the second time and we looked at her and she was like, God, the gums are really pale. They weren't like this the first time. And we had a concern for some sort of anemia. Mm-hmm. So we managed to get her back in and get a very small blood sample of her because we didn't really want to take a huge amount, especially of basically white gums. But we had no capillary tubes. And it's great. You can spin down a 1 mil tube if it's off a horse. But if it's a monkey and all you're getting out is like 0.5 mil, maybe less, you really want those capillary tubes. So I ended up getting a pen and then like a rubber tube in that was like really thin, taping it to the pen so it would be straight. And then injecting blood down one end until it was like filled up to the top and then got really heated up a needle and melted the bottom just so it would block out. And then we spun that. And we didn't have a specific number of what percentage it was. And we did get bloods the next day. We sent a boat off with the blood, but it was really bad. It was really bad. And the next day we got the blood results and it was about 7 or 10%
hematocrit. Ooh, that's not good. That's not good at all.
And
is it?
I remember going up to the director's house with other vet. And I just said to everyone, like, we don't know what's going on. I think we need to do a blood transfusion.
Yeah.
And bear in mind, this is, I think, 2 days after graduating. There's no other vet there. So that whole mentorship thing, I get what you mean. Like sometimes, but I was just like, you know what? I've come here to do a job. We need to do a blood transfusion.
Yeah.
Again, we don't have all the right tools for a blood transfusion. We discussed it as a team and then we ended up agreeing, like, if we want to buy her at least another day to try and figure out what's going on, we need to do the transfusion. So we ended up sedating the largest female capuchin that was still in captivity and fully released, and sedating this really sick monkey, which is a really tricky sedation to do when you've got 5% hematocrit. Luckily, my colleague who came out, Alice, she had done an internship in anesthesia and then she'd done, I think, 6 months in wildlife or zoological. So that is great to have her there. But I remember seeing her face when I said the blood transfusion thing as a new grad. And I was like, I've seen it in Kenya from ticks in dogs from the street, ticks like really severe anemia and happened to do it on the spot. And can't blood type. I don't even know if you could blood type for capuchins. I don't know how much research there is there, any of that.
There's a fair amount. I forget what type of grouping they have. So basically two types in primates. There's a human type, A, A, B, et cetera. But monkeys have this weird MN system, MNS or whatever, BA. Yeah. But yeah,
the middle of the Bolivian jungle with only together. One whole center where you could get internet and you had to, it was like a 15-minute walk up to the director's house to get satellite connection to look these things up, which I guess in normal practice, you can be like, okay, we're going to have a look at the case. And you just pop out back and it's, Julian, do you want to have a look at this? What do you think about this? Or you can look at Google or look at a book or something. We had none of that. And that's what I meant about it forces you to think back on like maybe first or second year lectures about this sort of stuff. Mm. And then the next thing was, once they were sedated, we actually didn't have a transfusion pack. So you want to stop the blood from clotting, right? That's the main thing with animal to animal transfusion.
It helps. Yeah.
It helps. So we ended up getting 30 1 ml heparin tubes lined up. And what I was doing, a femoral vein draw, popping it in the tube. Lottie, a veterinary student who was with us at the time, also my girlfriend, but was mixing them, putting them down, opening them. Alice, had managed to get a catheter in after about an hour of trying. We all had tried. Celia was flat. She was going critical. And the last one we tried was the tail vein. And Alice ended up having to hold a butterfly needle into the tail vein and couldn't move her hand. And she was just connecting, injecting, covering, taking it off, refilling. So Lottie would do the refills, pass it on, and I'd be taking it. And we had to do, I think we did 22 mils, and we kept 8 in reserve in case we needed to do another top up or something. And also, and
how heavy roughly was the cupboard?
Celia, 1.35 kilos.
Okay.
Yes, probably getting on for a quarter or so of her blood volume then, isn't it? Not too far off.
Yeah. I mean, she was bad. And we got a little bit of blood after just to double check it worked. And yet her hematocrit had gone back up. She perked up once she had recovered. She was eating, suddenly loads of energy. Success. We've treated her.
That's great.
Correct. I couldn't believe it. He was like, he couldn't believe it. Done a blood transfusion in the middle of the jungle with none of the right thoughts.
Yeah, that was the reaction from Lance Armstrong, wasn't it? In the Tour de France.
Yeah. Not much of a cyclist, but I think he was doping, wasn't he?
And transfusions.
Really? Oh, I guess if you get more plate,
More oxygen carrying capacity.
Yep, exactly. Red blood cells. Is it packed red blood cell transfusion, isn't it? He could also just go to the Himalayas and live at high altitude.
Oh, that takes too long, it's too expensive, and it doesn't have that dynamic impact as you approach the Champs-Élysées or Alpe d'Huez. You need to take it the day before or the night before.
Mm. Okay, so it peaks and then it's gone.
I know nothing at all about doping in cycling. And my time at British Cycling was very short. Moving on from that, come on then. I'm going to backtrack because you've shared a couple of really detailed case things there. But I want to go back because we're jumping all over the place.
Mm-hmm.
We've talked Bolivia, we've talked Baja, we've talked Bristol. Let's bring this into some chronological order here, Jamil. Okay. Right. So you graduated last year. When did you graduate?
I graduated. I received my certificates and stuff on the 16th of June. But I think I'd left the country on the 1st of June. I didn't even go to graduation.
So you didn't go to graduation.
I didn't see the point. I was like, there's these opportunities. They need a vet there now. They don't have a vet. What's the point of throwing a hat up and grabbing a piece of paper when I can be in the jungle working with jaguars, ocelots, capuchins, and spider monkeys?
I'll tell you, young man, I'll tell you. It would have been to give the dean his opportunity to tell you to go away to Bolivia.
I saw him the other day.
Yeah. Okay, good.
Okay. So they knew I wasn't going to show up. I'd spoken to them about it and I'd explained my reason, and it wasn't out of disrespect. It was more like, to me, there was more value in implementing what I had learned than picking up that piece of paper.
Sure.
Okay. Which I've only just picked up now. I've come back to the uni. I've got my certificates now.
So the take-home message is don't wait till after the ceremony then?
No, yeah.
That your message to final year students is what?
Depends what you want. I'd say chase your opportunities. Like, you're young, do the baptism of fire when you're young, and then you can relax, I think. Whilst all the information is fresh, go chase those opportunities, become a competent vet with rounded skills everywhere, figure out if you want to specialize or not, and then you can start building your life from there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think it's very difficult in the sense of not everyone has such a strong idea of what they want to do. Mm-hmm. I think that's difficult for new grads and final, fourth year students. Mm-hmm. It's tricky to go make those decisions if you aren't sure. If you're not sure if you want to be an equine vet, if you're not sure if you want to be a small animal vet. So I can say that, but I can say that with the caveat of, for me, it's always been very clear that I wanted to do emergency, wildlife, mixed animal practice with a focus on surgery, if possible. Right.
Okay, so what would you say to those that aren't quite sure then? They're approaching their finals. They've just gone through their finals. They still don't really know. They're not sure. They've got a couple of offers on the table of possibly going to work for...
I think go for quality of life.
Right.
If you're not sure, go for quality of life and keep all your doors open if possible. ultimately, I'd say in an ideal world, and it's ever more difficult to find these practices, especially in the UK, going to mixed practice with a nice package and a good mentorship scheme and something that's going to allow you to figure it out. Because if you go into a practice where it's chaos, there's the mentors are overworked, there's a lot of cases, and maybe you didn't negotiate the best package as your starting salary and other benefits, mm-hmm. then you're going to be really stressed. And I think it's very difficult to grow and have those internal thought processes that you need to have to get to the point of, I want to do this under stress. Because if you're constantly being hammered with things that you're not sure if you want to do, you're going to be so stressed and burnt out from it, which is what's happening to a lot of new grads, I think.
So you've liked watching movies. And so are you Butch Cassidy or are you the Sundance Kid?
I do not get the reference.
Or the one riding on the bike.
I don't get the reference. I'm too young.
Culture.
I'm a new grad.
The reference is, what? Why did you choose Bolivia? So in the film that Mike was suggesting, the eponymous heroes of Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid hid out in Bolivia. Made their final stand there. So, which are you? Why Bolivia?
Hang on, no. Surely the only reason to go to Bolivia is because it's a lawless society, and it's beyond the reach of people like the RCVS or the American boards.
The AVMA.
Yeah, so that's why.
And the feds and everyone.
Yeah.
Do what you like.
No, not really.
I like the way you had to pause. Do I offend them by saying no, or do I?
Yeah. I do like the lawlessness, the chaos, the adventure, the risk of death, snakes. I almost stepped on a massive one at one point. I almost got dragged down by a river when we had floods because I had to go and unreel the rope from the propeller on the boat because we were floating down the river and no one could get to the propeller because it was like 7 feet. So got off the boat and let myself get dragged down and caught onto the propeller pole and then did it and then climbed my way back up. I love that stuff. But why Bolivia? I saw a post from a friend who's Dr. Mahesh Bhatt. He does a lot of wildlife stuff. We'd been friends for years. We'd gone to Kenya. He'd also been a mentor to me, giving me advice on how to get into wildlife because it is very difficult, especially if you're not keen on doing internships and residencies like I was. And he posted on his Instagram story that this center was looking for a new vet that he was leaving. And the minute I saw that, I think I was lucky in the sense that I saw it within a few minutes of him posting. I was like, mate, can I go there? Can you put word in for you, the director? I'll go there straight away. Mm-hmm. Skip graduation. I can go there like soon as this date in May. And it went from there. Yes, I had sacrifice pay. The pay is very low in these sort of jobs and especially in those sort of countries. I think I'm probably one of the few new grads that went into a job like that and actually got paid. A lot of the times they volunteer, so they'll give you accommodation, food, but you won't get paid. Mm-hmm. So that's something that I do want to emphasize to students that are about to graduate is to also recognize their worth. I did have to negotiate for that, as I've had to negotiate for all my
salaries. I was gonna say, you know, strangers to that, you negotiated funding for the whole of your veterinary course and
I'm very used.
You've got a few tips on that perhaps to give later, but yeah,
sure. So but in essence, to sum it up, is like Bolivia, I could get the species I'd always wanted to work with, big cats, monkeys in essence. It was deep, like in the jungle. You had to get a boat to it, 15 minutes up the river. And then there was no internet, electricity cuts all the time. You had to run around barefoot, walk a jaguar barefoot, you know. It was done safely, but obviously it's a higher risk environment. But I'd also argue that it's higher reward in the short term. Mm-hmm. Now, is that for everyone? Probably not, to be honest. I've always had a chaotic life of high stress, high whatever. Pretty sure I have ADHD. So I can't remember if it was Mike or Julian was alluding to earlier. There's job types that fit personality types. And that kind of constant chaos, I'm actually a lot more calm when there's chaos going on. So I can focus when there's chaos, when there's high stress. That's when I'm happy.
That's when you're grounded.
There's nothing going on and it's like vaccinations and stuff. I get itchy. But you can start hearing this.
Yeah.
All the fidgeting, all the spinning, all the walking around. So for me, it was just the perfect opportunity. The only sacrifice was the pay. I did get paid. I had enough to survive and stuff. But as a consequence of making that rogue decision, I've got to dart a jaguar. I've got to dart an ocelot. I've got to dart multiple spider monkeys. I've got to dart capuchins. I've treated squirrel monkeys, all the previously mentioned animals as well. I got called in by the town hall to help out with one of these night monkeys that got electrocuted. I was going to the community, helping with their animals. Yeah, it just gave you this whole world of opportunities that just, to me, weren't there in England.
Yeah.
Now, I don't know what you think, Julian, because
I quite agree.
Do you think the opportunities are disappearing? Although not anyone's fault. I think
there have never been opportunities in England to go and dart jaguars. The opportunities, yeah. So I qualified in 1996, and after 6 months of qualifying, I'd probably done more spinal surgery than I had done bitch space, because at the time there were very few referral surgeons nearby that were able to do. There's no MRI, no CT available. And so I was quite uniquely advantaged to indulge my interest in spinal surgery.
Yeah,
that's not going to happen. And I think quite rightly, because things have moved on, clients now have a greater range of expertise. I wasn't a give-it-a-go person. I didn't just, oh, go on, let's try it. Everything I did was as researched as it could be, as practiced as it could be. But would I have those chances now? No, certainly not. Unless I decided to become an intern as an orthopedic or specialist neurology unit or whatever. So yeah, you're right. Those basic opportunities in this country, the opportunities for having a much more varied surgical, not even internship, but surgical chance in a first opinion practice, I don't think are there anymore. But there are plenty of other opportunities. There are more internships, there are more residences, there are more mentor positions. But if you just want to go and have...
Are there, though?
Sorry?
Are there, though?
Yeah, there are.
The residencies and stuff, what I've heard from interns is you need to do 2 internships now for certain residencies. I don't know. I've never looked into it because I've been like, fuck that. Yeah. I don't want to go back into education for a super low pay when I'm going to be watching the residents do all of it anyway. It's back to being a student.
It is. And I spoke to a specialist, a very well-renowned specialist a couple of weeks back, who said that they don't get the opportunity to operate anymore because all their surgery is done by the residents, because otherwise they wouldn't have a chance to do it.
No, of course. So
it's a double-edged sword. There are a lot more opportunities for new grads than there were in terms of specialising, in terms of doing more things, but it doesn't necessarily mean you're going to get to do them. The money may not be there, the cases may not be there. I think the halcyon days, to my mind, were back in the 80s and 90s, and I was lucky enough to be there. But it is still an incredibly rewarding profession for people to go into it with their eyes open. A lot of the people who get burnout perhaps are looking for things other than what's actually out there, and maybe didn't research the job properly before. However, having said that, there are an awful lot more mental health struggles that new grads have to face. And I don't know whether we had that many struggles when I qualified. I have my own demons to battle with, but we all do. None of us come with a completely clean slate, do we? I think it's a tougher job now. There are more pressures. There are more pressures to make money from day one. Mm. There are more pressures to get things right from day one. And some of those are internal pressures. Some of them are external pressures. There are more pressures to find a direction. I started off in mixed practice, and after 3 years, honed down to the small animal route. These days, people think, okay, I'm 2 months in and I haven't yet decided whether I want be a medical specialist, whether I want to do just laminectomies, whether I want to do hoof surgery. What am I? Why, oh my God, I'm so far behind the ball on this one.
Thank people like Jamil for that pressure, because he knows what he wants to do.
Yeah.
He's going to go out there and he's going to set the scheme, and everybody is going to have to follow Jamil. And Jamil knew what he wanted to do before he'd even graduated, got the piece of paper, and he'd gone off to Bolivia.
4 years old.
And chased. Yeah. Jamil, so we've ascertained that allegedly you didn't go to Bolivia to avoid the Pinkerton Detective Agency chasing you for robbing trains of gold. And you obviously didn't meet your end in Bolivia. You've alluded to the fact that you ended up in Baja in California.
Yes.
So is that what happened?
In essence, just before I graduated, I became, I don't know if you're familiar with figs.
Figs, yes.
Yeah, they're scrubbed around.
Very good. You use them instead of apricots in a tagine.
And really nice.
Fruit flavor.
They're nice with cheese as well.
Very good with
cheese. Yeah, which is odd, isn't it? Because you wouldn't think of that as a fruit. But yeah, cheese, chocolate. Yeah. I've had figs stuffed into quail. They're a nice quail stuffed fig.
Yeah, and once you've eaten the fruit, of course, the leaves are particularly good if you're feeling slightly shy when you're on the nudist beach.
I've never thought, I know they had that leaf, Adam and Eve or whatever, but has anyone broken a fig leaf off and seen that white liquid that comes out? That is really itchy and causes rashes. So I don't know how Adam and Eve are feeling, but that is not the leaf I would pick.
I was really worried then, because you said you break that leaf off in that little white thing. And I was thinking, my God, he's seen me on the beach. He's actually seen me. He's seen me doing the fig leaf dance. Oh, man. Yeah. What is figs then?
They're, in essence, a medical clothing brand. So they
do
a lot of the scrubs for whoever buys them. But they also have quite a few ambassadors around the world, and they do a lot of impact work, they call it. So more like NGO work or charity work.
All right. Okay.
So I was presented with the opportunity to join their team as an ambassador just before graduating.
Mm-hmm. Right.
To me, that was like incredible. It's like one of the biggest brands out there. And I haven't even graduated yet. And I made it very clear from the beginning, from that initial meeting, that I was in this to do charity work, to do NGO work, that I wanted to go to low resource areas. As much as I respect high level fancy surgeons who can do mitral valve repair, that isn't for me, because with those £30,000 that procedure costs, you could probably fund a charity or an NGO for 2 years in certain countries to treat probably 6,000 dogs. The one in Mexico told me they ran on $20,000 a year and did around 3,500 dogs a year.
Wow.
Which is why I always know that's the sort of work I want to go into. I know I need money as well, which is why I've got to go and do these other jobs. But I've always felt like, if you have those skill sets, and again, this is very personal to me. I don't want anyone to then go and take this and feel like they have some sort of pressure. But for me, if I have these skill sets, to some extent, I have a duty to go and give back and try and help wherever possible to those that can't afford or access that sort of treatment.
That's a very admirable ethos.
It is. Yeah, absolutely.
I've had a lot of people help me on my journey. So I think it's just one of those giving back things. And I think that industry is very, not famous, but there is a lot of giving back in the industry. I think everyone tries to give back once they graduate in one way or another, if it's mentoring students. So everyone's playing a role in that. And it's generational knowledge, if you think about it. That's my fear with the corporatization of it, is losing that, the beauty of that, that you have generations of vets that pass on their knowledge. And now you have courses which you can do an MCQ and watch some videos online, and it's not the same. To me, it doesn't have the same touch.
Sure. Okay.
Well, I think that's perfectly valid. So you before you left college then, you became a fig leaf ambassador.
Yes, a fig leaf ambassador.
Is that where the name figs comes from? Because it was a traditional coverall from way back in the Old Testament.
I think that unofficially, from what I've heard, that is where the name figs came from for the scrub. Because it was the first farming, hence they were like, okay, we'll be called figs. Anyway, because I voiced those things from the very beginning, and I've done a lot of charity work in Kenya, Armenia, as you mentioned, recently Bolivia, I ended up getting selected as one of the ambassadors that got taken out to Mexico. And the idea was to do a Spay & Neuter campaign in collaboration with Baja Spay & Neuter. Mm-hmm. They brought a lot of other ambassadors in, some really, like, just all of them incredible. If I had to pick a practice to work in, that would be the team I'd have. And that's ended up being in Mexico. And then I ended up staying an extra week because I was like, could you book my return flight a week later and I can stay on and learn from the Mexican surgeons. Mexican surgeons, Dr. Rebecca, I have heard the myths of her doing open to close bitch spay in 2 minutes, 30 seconds, I think. I personally saw her do it in 7 minutes there. Like, I sneakily timed it. Mm-hmm. And she wasn't racing. She was chatting to me and she did it in 7 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
So this kind of leads on to what I wanted to ask you guys, especially with like lap spays, which are trendy now in the UK. Is it better to have this high-end gold standard technology?
I do a two-port approach for lap spays.
I do two-port.
So Labrador would have one to one, 1 centimetre model. So
we were doing probably 1 to 2 centimetre incisions. And just by how they taught me out there, I got my normal bitch spay probably down from 45 minutes to an hour, depending on the case, down to 25 minutes to 35 minutes. In a week.
That's very good. That's very good. It's not all about time. So the greatest...
But for me, it was time under anesthesia, right?
Well, time under anesthesia is part of the problem of the thing we want to try and reduce. It's pain. Now, the most painful part of a spay is tugging on the ovarian ligaments.
Yeah.
And one of the perceived benefits, and I think now evidenced benefits, of laparoscopic spaying is... there's no tugging on that ovarian ligament. It's cut without any tension on it. The ovary itself is removed through those small holes, closed up. The dog can go back to routine exercise the following day. And the post-op recovery is shorter, but also pain relief under the anesthesia isn't...
I mean, some of our dogs had to go back to the street that same evening.
Oh, sure. Absolutely. I'm not saying that the routine spaying is bad. And they're saying that there have been studies that have shown advantages of laparoscopic spay in terms of analgesia and in terms of post-op comfort. Well,
that's the question, is there are clearly advantages to it and there's clearly advantages to not doing it. Mm. The thing for me is, if you can get your surgeons down to doing it sub 15 minutes, sub 10 minutes, I think the cost of doing a dog out there was $10 per dog, and they were very generous in the sense that they paid the local vets quite a high salary, and that's what ramped up the cost, but that wasn't reflected on the people coming to us. All the surgeries were free. But in terms of equipment and resources and medications, it was $10 a dog. If you can do a dog in under 15, say, let's say 20 minutes to be generous, right? If you can do that at $10, in and out very quickly, is it worth chasing these gold standards?
We're talking about the difference between private practice and a welfare state or charitable state practice.
Yeah.
And you can't equate the two. Very fast doesn't necessarily mean lower pain and a more or less painful recovery. The concept of a minimally invasive approach, that doing less physical harm, transferring to a doing less nociceptive harm, psychological harm, physical harm, all comes down to the tiniest imprint or insult to the body that you can make. So a smaller incision, a smaller cut means less anesthetic needed, less analgesics needed, therefore a quicker recovery and less impactful on the patient. And if you take those concepts without worrying about how much it costs to do it, take those concepts, and I hate the concept of gold standard, because gold standard is meaningless, but an evidence-based approach always leads down to a minimally invasive approach.
Completely agree.
So, but it's
horses for courses.
Yeah.
I think you could equally make a very strong argument and business case for operating that same way in a third world country such as the UK.
Yes.
Very easily.
Especially of how it is now. It's changed a lot in 7 months. I've come back and I'm shocked at the food prices.
Yeah. I think that there is a very good argument there. And I think there's also potentially, I'm going to speak way out of turn here, I detect that there might be a growing movement within veterinary medicine of doing, I can't think of a better word, so I'm going to use the word basic.
Mm-hmm.
Basic, traditional, possibly old-fashioned. I'm struggling for the words to describe this style of veterinary medicine.
Pragmatic.
Yeah. Practical. Yeah. Not necessarily back as far as James Herriot, but certainly a 20 years ago style of medicine. And I could see that could be a growing movement that is happening now as a potential, is it a backlash? Is it a yin and yang thing?
Mm.
It's an opposite to the drive that the patient has to be referred and has to have an MRI and has to have laparoscopic surgery done under hypnosis, whatever. I'm acutely aware here that I'm talking to somebody who's left college and has spent his time since then. And how long have you, when were you released? How long have you been out?
Within 8 months, I think.
8 months, okay. Yeah. So within 8 months, has garnered a lot of the skills that would slot right into that movement if that is actually a movement. And as I say, I'm speaking out of turn here because I don't know.
I don't think you are speaking out of turn, Mike, because we've discussed this sort of thing before. Mm. What it comes down to, I think, is giving clients all the options, not just saying to them, look, your dog needs an MRI scan. Your dog needs a CT scan. We can do that. That's fine. We can remove this lump from its side and it'll be £8,000. Okay, so the best evidence-based approach we have at the moment would be to do a fine needle aspirate to remove the mass according to the results of the fine needle aspirate with or without a margin. Depending on, again, the results of the FNA, we may want to do some chest x-rays, we might do some abdominal ultrasounds, we may want to do some more blood work, some more involved blood work. We'll remove the lump, send it off to the lab. We may then want to send it for immunohistochemistry. We may want to look for further margins on it. And after that, we may want to do follow-up radiotherapy or chemotherapy. That's going to cost you £15,000. Oh, I haven't got that. Oh, there we go. We'll put it to sleep. No, we have all the options available from, let's keep it on steroids to try and shrink this mass down, to, let's do everything we can. And if that's what you want to do, then we can refer you to the people who will tell you how best to do that. Can you remove it? Yes, we can remove it. Now, it may come back, it may not. My preference would be to do a histopathology on it. That's what I'd really strongly recommend. I can't afford that. In that case, you're aware that there's a risk it's going to come back, we'll do it. And it's giving them all those options, isn't it? What happens if I don't do anything? I don't know what happens. Let's wait and see, shall we? Because actually that's an option if it's not in pain.
From the what I was going to add to what Mike was saying was, I really like the fact that we've got such advanced technology in veterinary medicine now, and that more and more stuff is coming over from human medicine. It's great. Caveat to it, it raises the cost drastically. Mm-hmm. But my fear as a new grad, and it's why I ended up going and seeking these experiences outside of the UK, was obviously they're going to train you in those basic skills, I'm assuming in England, but at a lot slower pace because there's a lot less case availability. And furthermore, there's lower case availability, and out of the cases that are available, a certain percentage are going to go with lab space because, as you've said, evidence-based currently, that might be the best way to do it. I don't think that's a great starting point for a new grad. For me personally, I'd feel more comfortable learning the basics first for that day when there isn't a lap spay or there's a power cut or for whatever reason it wasn't sterilized and we can't offer that service.
I go further and say that you shouldn't be doing lap spays until you're very competent at doing a normal routine mesh spay because, as you say, there's a power cut. You run out of CO2. The equipment just doesn't work that day. The sealing unit doesn't work. You hit the spleen. What are you going to do? You need to have a plan B. And with any surgery, there needs to be a plan B and a plan C. And then what if plans A, B, and C don't work? You need to have a plan D as well.
Well, then there's figs. If you've got plan A, plan B, plan C, plan D, and then figs.
I do like that. I do love working with figs because I've had other sponsors and stuff, and they've all been incredible. But the sort of level figs is going to with giving back. Mm-hmm. So Mexico, an interesting thing that happened, the trailer with all the surgical equipment and medical stuff, all anesthetics, everything was in that trailer, got stolen whilst we were there.
Right.
I don't think it took figs even 24 hours to come up with a $20,000 check to give to the charity, and they replaced everything and they're back up and running already. On top of all the funding they'd invested for everyone to come, and they brought a load of stuff anyway. That's the sort of company I would be very keen to work for, and I'd love it. I don't know if vet companies are doing that sort of work. I haven't asked and I don't know, but I don't see why we couldn't, unless our profit margins are so small that it doesn't allow for that.
That's the thing. Now, some of the bigger companies, certainly the multinational ones, are giving a lot of money back. Some of the smaller ones are doing the best they can. But the veterinary market in this country, even though we think of it as being huge, in terms of an international, multinational corporations, it's small business, really. I had a quick look at figs, actually, while you were talking to Mike a moment ago, and they gave something like $700,000 in the last year to the various charities.
Wow. Yeah, and I think they've invested.
That's a lot of scrub tops.
They sound like a great company. So, Jamil, you tell me that you answered a Facebook ad pretty much, and that took you to Bolivia. Is there any advice you would give to any of your colleagues that are just leaving college or just about to leave college based on that?
For sure, if you've got a direct in to get a job with someone you know and you know you can work well in that practice and they've offered you a job, I think that's always a good option, especially if you've gone on placement there and you know what sort of environment is fostered there and what sort of mentorship's provided. Mm-hmm. But if you don't and you don't have those contacts like I didn't, you can always reach out to people who might know them, who are within your friend circle. And I know it's like that whole thing of trying to find placements when you're trying to get into university because you need 8 weeks on a farm or something. And you ask your aunt's friend, who's this person's mum, who's a friend with a farmer, who's happy to have you. I think with jobs, a lot of it's the same thing. And if you do it through personal contacts, or there's an element of a personal contact in there, my opinion on it is it warrants you some form of protection, because someone who's your friend isn't going to allow you or recommend you go somewhere where you're not going to be taken care of.
Mm-hmm. No.
Whereas if you apply directly, and I'm not saying the corporates or any practice is bad, you don't know what you're going into. But when you have someone who's helping you find that opportunity, they have your best interests at heart, not the financial.
Personal recommendations.
Yeah.
So in effect, what you're talking about there really is developing a network.
Yes.
Okay. So do you use things like Instagram, LinkedIn, Facebook? What role do they have in your life developing your network?
By far, and this is going to sound ridiculous, I think most the professional opportunities I've got, including Veterinary Ramblings, have come from Instagram.
Instagram?
Yep.
Okay.
Figs, Instagram, Arminia, Instagram, Kenya, Instagram, Bolivia, Instagram, Mexico by default because of figs, Instagram. It sounds ridiculous, but because only people who are interested in what you're interested in are going to follow you, and you're only going to follow people. There are people, I did it when I was young, I was like, follow everything. And then over the years, I'd be like, oh, I need to filter out all of this crap and get it down to what I like. It's a natural filtering process. And if you people put jobs up there, they also give a lot of advice out. Don't be afraid of pinging them a message and don't feel bad or feel rejected if they don't answer you. You also need to remember it's social media. They might get a million messages, especially if you message someone with 50,000 followers. Mm-hmm. But more often than not, I have found you do get a reply, surprisingly. And I don't know if saying this means that now everyone's going to message and it's going to destroy that whole system. But I don't think that will be the case. There's plenty to go around for everyone and there's plenty of mentors and advice. Another thing is your mentor doesn't need to be in the practice with you. It's ideal if you have a mentor in the practice. I'd say that's optimal, especially for your clinical skills. But you can have other mentors outside of that setting. Ones who can give you advice on how you're struggling. I'd consider you guys mentors to some extent because I can ping you a message about things or queries. Or Mike, if I had a question about anesthesia or machine, I would definitely message you.
Bless you. That's very kind.
No, but do you know what I mean?
Slightly misguided, but very kind.
With surgeries and referral level stuff. And that's just by meeting on online. And then I got the placement with you, Julian, by doing this. Yeah. So it's a spider web of connections.
Yeah.
I think it is. And there's this global village idea, isn't there?
Yeah.
Why can't we actually all help each other?
Yeah.
And it's not a case of, why are you talking to him? Why are you giving him advice? He's not even in our practice.
So, put yourself out there, really, and don't be afraid to put yourself out there.
There's an element of marketing yourself.
Yeah.
And I think that's probably what I maybe got right with Instagram, was how to tell a story and how to engage with the right people. And I've always been very aware that any job you apply to, and Julian, I'm sure you've looked up a lot of candidates. This is when you can correct me if I'm wrong.
Mm-hmm.
I've always thought one of the first thing people do is Google your name or look you up on LinkedIn or something. One of those things that's going to lead to that. And if you look like, this is also the problem with it. But if you look like a decent person who's passionate about what they're doing, who genuinely cares, that's going to go miles for you. Like, it will really help.
Yeah. Yes.
Whereas if there's no face to the person they look up, doesn't even show up, or maybe it's a LinkedIn without a profile picture and the last update was their GCSEs, but they're a doctor, I'm going to pick the candidate I can see more about and that's clearly passionate and expose themselves more. Do I think that's right? No, I think the best way is to meet person face to face. And then you can really gauge the caliber of that person. But in the world we currently are, you need to face the facts. And this is how we're moving. Look at LinkedIn. It's like bloody Facebook business.
It is. It is. You're absolutely right. And any advantage is not unfair, is it?
So the take-home message there is reach out, build your network. So you've been doing a lot of learning.
Yes.
In your very short 8 months post-graduation here. Now, we've obviously spoken to you before and we had a great time and you told us a lot of stories on our last meeting. And so you've been off around the world now doing a lot more. But let me cast your mind back, because I'm of an age to where I would forget little details like this, but perhaps you can remember. We have a section on the show called 60-Second CPD. Do you remember that?
Yes, and I remember what I said as well.
That's just freaky.
That's weird. That's weird.
Hey, Jamil, I'm going to challenge you. Are you up for a 60-second CPD challenge tonight?
Yes, I'm happy to do more.
Okay, so you're up for this then. That's fantastic. Yeah. What are you going to do it on?
The pressures of being a new grad and learning how to build teams.
Okay, all right. So 60-second CPD challenge. Jamil Dowling, the pressures of being a new grad and how to incorporate some of that into a new team, starting now.
So I feel like as new grads, a lot of us, and especially myself, you have this sense of needing to perform at a certain level to prove, you know, now you've got your degree, you are a vet, so you are going to have to be capable of doing all of these incredible things. And I definitely had that in my mind, which is why I was so obsessed about getting so many surgeries in before I graduated. But what I learned in Bolivia and, you know, with Alice, Dr. Alice, was incredible. It's you don't have to be this superhero. You can ask for help. You can reach out to colleagues. And actually, the more you do that, the better, and the more they're going to respect you. I was always fearful of, if I ask these questions, are they going to think I'm not a good vet? And the reality is, I think they appreciate the honesty. And if you can openly discuss things you're not sure about with them, or reach out to other colleagues, it's going to make your life easier and make your team happier, and you're going to become a better vet. On the dot.
Wow.
Look at that.
Absolutely perfect.
I don't know if I would consider it CPD, and that's what I struggle with, these things, but okay. I guess other new grads to listen to that, I'd find that very reassuring. And I know it's something that's been said to me, until you experience it, and until you, I think you have to go through it to really understand that message, especially if you're like my personality type, which can be borderline, very confident, overconfident, which I haven't crossed that line yet, but you struggle with admitting areas of weakness. And they're not even areas of weakness. It's like, if you haven't had the experience, if you haven't had the knowledge or have it taught to you, how are you supposed to know that? And come into terms of that and realizing that, I think, is really
critical. I think I agree with you, Jamil. That you're right. You know, just a quick 60 seconds blast out there. Is that really CPD? And of course, I think the RCVS, the Royal College of Veterinary Surgeons, would also agree with you that that isn't proper CPD. For two reasons. Not because it wasn't good quality, and not because it was short, but because you haven't posed a reflection question.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So let's tick that one off.
Yeah.
Have you got a reflection question for our audience? Mindful that not all are vet students and not all are veterinary surgeons.
If you can think of a moment where you maybe got angry or felt attacked or something because someone gave you some advice, try and think about why you felt that way. I'm going to leave it at that, because I think that depends on every individual. But the more you start thinking about those moments, I think the more you start realizing that your reaction probably teaches you more about yourself than about the person. And a lot of the times I've realized that it's not that I had an outburst with them or anything. I, you know, always worked really well with them. But sometimes I felt very, why are they telling me what? And I think if you're capable, and sometimes it happens a month later, of going back home and sitting down and thinking, you know what, remove all the stress, remove all the politics, problems going on wherever you are. If you can identify what's made you have those feelings, you can then start working on why, and maybe change it. Maybe you'll react differently. Maybe you'll figure out there's a hole in your knowledge you need to fill, but that's up to each person.
So what you're saying is reflect back on some of
tougher moments,
the tougher elements. Would you include reflecting back on where the other person is coming from?
Yes, exactly. But that's what I didn't want to give away. But in many ways, it's try and put yourself in their shoes. And it's a lot of how you receive things is how you interpret them. It doesn't mean that's how it was put out there. There is no objective truth in reality. Everything's subjective. Mm. But if you can start trying to put yourself outside of your own subject and try and look at it from another subject point of view, maybe you'll reach a bit more of a middle ground, and it'll show you things about yourself as well.
It's back to that old story of something along the lines of, if you have an argument with someone, if you have a row with someone, or about to have a fight with someone, put yourself in their shoes. And actually, if you then walk a mile in those shoes, then firstly, you may well have reflected that they're probably not that long to start with. And secondly, you'll be a mile away from them, they'll have no shoes, they'll never catch you up, you'll be safe.
Exactly.
It's a lot cheaper than a divorce lawyer. The second thing, apart from the reflection question, of course, that would make the 60-second CPD valid, I think it's perfectly valid, but valid in the eyes